we present Lines from My Grandfather's Forehead, a sequential entertainment for radio, starring Ronnie Barker, also featuring Terence Brady and Pauline Yates, with Gordon Langford at the piano. Today, Lines from My Grandfather's Forehead is privileged to present an interview with a man who has become a legend in his lifetime, a man who left these shores to become one of the brightest stars in the world of films. Interviewed now by Terence Brady, our guest, Charles Chaplin.
Mr. Chaplin, this is indeed a great honor.
Yes, quite. I know.
Mr. Chaplin, may I start by asking you to talk a little about what is possibly your greatest success in d'estime, City Lights?
Yeah. City what?
City Lights, Mr. Chaplin. To many people, your greatest single achievement.
Yeah. I'm sorry, I can't keep it up any longer.
I beg your pardon, Mr. Chaplin.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Oh, God, your face. I thought I could keep it up, but I can't. Oh, dear.
Yes, obviously, Mr. Chaplin, it would seem that something in my physical appearance has clearly struck an answering chord in your well-known sense of the ridiculous.
Not half.
Is this, in fact, how you put down the roots, the fundamental raison d'etre for the characters you create? You know, dig into the rich soil of life, so
yeah,
to speak.
Dig in, yeah.
Mr. Chaplin.
Yes. Oh, that's rich, that is. Fundamental raison d'etre. I'm not Chaplin, you great twit.
Now, don't be silly, Mr. Chaplin. Of course you're Chaplin. Mr. Chaplin, tell me, when you were making Monsieur Verdoux...
I'm not Chaplin, I tell you. Oh, dear. Laugh. I'm Jack Benson, the well-known practical joker.
You're not.
I am. Honest. I've been working on this coupe for weeks, months.
Rubbish.
Years. Of course I have. What about all them cables, then? All them cables from Switzerland to your producer saying I would come, and then I wouldn't come, then I would come. I can quote them all if you don't believe me.
But the film clips, the excerpts from your films.
I had them all done special, didn't I? All soot and whitewash. Shot them last month round the back of Chiswick Town Hall.
I don't believe you.
Oh, your face is as good as a play.
But you look like Chaplin, for God's sake.
Well, plastic surgery. I mean, simple, isn't it? I had it done special up Harley Street. It's good, isn't it? Eh?
Oh, all right. We'll have to make the best of it, I suppose.
Yeah.
Mr. Jack Benson, would you tell me first...
No, that's not my real name.
No?
No. No, it's Temple. Shirley Temple. But you can call me Frank Sinatra, if you like.
Strange things done in the midnight sun by the men who moil for gold. The Arctic trails have their secret tales that would make your blood run cold. The northern lights have seen queer sights, but the queerest they ever did see was that night on the marge of Lake Lebarge, I cremated Sam McGee. On a Christmas day, we were mushing our way over the Dawson Trail. Talk of your cold, through the parka's fold, it stabbed like a driven nail. Sam held his head and staggered and said, I'll cash in this trip, I guess. And if I do, I'm asking that you won't refuse my last request. Well, he seemed so low that I couldn't say no. Then he says with a sort of moan, it's the cursed cold, and it's got right hold till I'm chilled clean through to the bone. Yet 'tain't being dead, it's my awful dread of the icy grave that pains. So I want you to swear that foul or fair, you'll cremate my last remains. A pal's last need is a thing to heed, so I swore that I would not fail. And we started on at the streak of dawn, but God, he looked ghastly pale. He crouched on the sleigh and he raved all day of his home in Tennessee. And before nightfall, a corpse was all that was left of Sam McGee. Now a promise made is a debt unpaid, and the trail has its own stern code. In the days to come, though my lips were dumb, in my heart how I cursed that load. It was last of the sleigh, and it seemed to say, you may tax your brawn and brains, but your promise true, and it's up to you to cremate these last remains. And every day that quiet clay seemed to heavy and heavier grow. And on I went, though the dogs were spent and the grub was getting low. The trail was bad and I felt half mad, but I swore I would not give in. And I'd often sing to the hateful thing, and it hearkened with a grin. Till I came to the marge of Lake Lebarge, and a derelict boat there lay. It was jammed in the ice, but I saw in a trice it was called the Alice May. And I looked at it, and I thought a bit, and I looked at my frozen chum. Then here, said I, with a sudden cry, is my crematorium. Some planks I tore from the cabin floor, and I lit the boiler fire. Some coal I found, it was lying around, and I heaped the fuel higher. The flames just soared, and the furnace roared, such a blaze you seldom see. And I burrowed a hole in the glowing coal, and I stuffed in Sam McGee. Then I made a hike, for I didn't like to hear him sizzle so. And the heavens scowled, and the huskies howled, and the winds began to blow. It was icy cold, but the hot sweat rolled on my cheeks, and I don't know why. And the greasy smoke in an inky cloak went streaking down the sky. I do not know how long in the snow I wrestled with grisly fear, but the stars came out, and they danced about ere again I ventured near. I was sick with dread, but I bravely said, I'll just take a peep inside. I guess he's cooked, and it's time I looked. And the door I opened wide. And there sat Sam, looking cool and calm in the heat of the furnace roar. And he wore a smile you could see a mile, and he said, please close that door. It's fine in here, but I greatly fear you'll let in the cold and storm. Since I left Plumtree down in Tennessee, it's the first time I've been warm.
Hermione. My dearest Hermione, will you marry me?
Oh, Watcher, desirous as I am of entering a state of hymeneal bliss, and adorable though you certainly are, I feel bound to inform you that with regard to a betrothal, I am already committed elsewhere.
I don't get you.
Precisely.
This place isn't what it used to be. My soup seems to have sand in it. Cold sand, too.
My salmon tastes as if it's been smoked by an old clay pipe.
Oh, the service has gone downhill as well. I mean, look at our waiter. Even his shoes seem to be splashed with gravy.
And he's got last night's camembert all over his sleeve. I'd love a glass of iced water.
Oh, I'm sorry, darling. Asked him twice already. It's absolutely hopeless. I say, waiter! Waiter!
Yes, that's right. Raise one finger and shout at me across the dining room as if it were a barrack square, and I'll come running, even though I have been on duty since 6:30 this morning, and here I am still on my feet. At least I think I am. They're so numb I can't be sure. 9:00 and you're both still on the first course. Come 10:30, you'll be shouting for another drambuie and a creme de malt to go with a third coffee, and I'll come running, and I'll be emptying that ashtray for the 15th time, and all for a 2-bob tip, because I can weigh up customers, and I know that although you're wearing a mauve silk shirt and have gone too far with the aftershave, and although your lady friend has an emerald ring the size of a Brussels sprout, I know that you're a lousy tipper, and you'll choose the cheapest most nastiest wine on the wine list and complain because you think it's corked, although you hardly know the difference between a claret and a clarinet, and now, because you look as if you're not enjoying your soup, and because you think you're a funny man, you're going to ask me what sort of soup it's supposed to be, and I'll tell you it's bean soup, and then you'll snigger and say you asked for its recipe, not its history, and with any luck, perhaps your girlfriend with the hole in her tights will find a cockroach on her plate, and she'll scream, and I'll be able to tell her not to shout in case everyone else wants one. I wanted to say that for years, but I've never had the chance.
Waiter! I say, waiter!
I haven't forgotten the ice water, but there isn't a clean jug, Andy, and I'm not going to go chasing down to that kitchen for ice, because I know the fridge hasn't been defrosted for 3 months or more, so he knows what he can do.
Waiter!
Oh, I'm so sorry, sir. Can I get you something?
I did ask for a jug of iced water.
Oh, it's on its way, sir. So sorry to keep you waiting.
That's quite all right.
Your smoked salmon all right, madam?
Oh, delicious, thank you.
And your soup, sir?
Oh, very good. Very good.
I'll just chase up that jug of water then, sir.
No hurry.
What's the matter, darling?
Nothing. Just something in my soup. Looks like it. Oh, good heavens.
Ugh. How revolting. Why not tell the waiter?
No. No, I don't want him to think we're being difficult.
Be off then.
Right. That's one tea
and a sausage roll. One shilling and fourpence. Thanks, mate.
Thanks. I'll see you tomorrow night.
Right.
He was a bit busy earlier.
Oh.
Round about 10.
10, was it?
Yeah, about then, yeah. I passed by here about then.
Oh, yeah?
I noticed you were doing a bit of trade.
Yeah. Yeah, trade was very brisk here about 10.
Yeah, I noticed. I sold my last one about then. Yeah. About 9:45.
Sold your last then, did you?
Yeah, my last evening news it was. Went about 20 to 10.
Evening news, was it?
Yeah. Sometimes it's, what's his name's the last to go?
Standard.
Yeah. All I had left tonight was the evening news.
Then that went, did it?
Yeah. Like a shot.
You didn't have any left, eh?
No. Not after I sold that one.
It was after that you must have come by here then, was
it? Yeah, I come by here after that, see, after I packed up.
You didn't stop here, though, did you?
When?
I mean, you didn't stop here and have a cup of tea then, did you?
Well, about 10.
Yeah.
No. No, I went up to Victoria.
No, I thought I didn't see you.
I had to go up to Victoria.
Yeah, trade was very brisk here about then.
I went to see if I could get hold of George.
Who?
George.
George who?
George, what's his name?
Oh. Did you get hold of him?
No. I couldn't get hold of him. I couldn't locate him.
He's not about much now, is he?
When did you last see him, then?
Oh, I haven't seen him for years.
No, nor me.
Used to suffer very bad from arthritis.
Arthritis?
Yeah.
He never suffered from arthritis.
Suffered very bad.
Well, not when I knew him.
I think he must have left the area.
Yeah. It was the evening news was the last to go tonight.
Not always the last, though, is it?
No. I mean, sometimes it's the standard. No way of telling beforehand. Till you've got your last one left, of course. Then you can tell which one it's going to be.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Well, I won't wait about for George. I think you must have left the area.
Since I first met you, I can't forget you. I want you for my own, but you won't be hurried. You've got me worried. You always want to be alone, but I must arrange, dear, for you to change, dear, and see my point of view. For you suggest, dear, all that is best, dear, the things that I like you. You remind me of a slice of raspberry tart. I'd love to take a bite right out of you. You're as pretty as a costermonger's cart, succulent as Irish stew with dumplings. You remind me of a golf umbrella just before the rain soaks through. And what is so ironic, you want it kept platonic. What am I gonna do about you? You remind me of a picture house in Stoke. You're friendly, you're warm, and you're dark. When you wear that dress with flowers around the yoke, you remind me of St. James's Park last Thursday. You're as sparkling as the Crystal Palace, as jazzy as a correspondent's shoe. My brain is in a whirl, if only you weren't a girl, what am I going to do about you? You're an absolute fizz on the dance floor with that low-fronted dress that you wear. And when we do the Big Apple, they remark what a beautiful pair, they're lovely. You remind me of the Lord Mayor's show, 'cause I think you're the biggest thing in town. You're just like a book by Edgar Allan Poe. When I pick you up, I cannot put you down till bedtime. You remind me of a knife and fork and spoon. I'd love to eat breakfast with you. Yet you never say goodnight without putting up a fight. What am I going to do about you? You say that you must be home early, that staying out late isn't fun. Yet when you went racing with Curly, you came home at 20-1, hot favorite. You remind me of a pair of Oxford bags. I don't feel quite at home without you now. You're like Everest with all its icy crags. I don't think I'll get over you somehow. I'm beside myself, I'm jumping up and down, behaving like the monkeys in the zoo. I wonder, just supposing I were to try proposing, what about trying that with you? And that's what I'm gonna do about you.
Theater? Yeah, yes, well, I used to go regularly during the war and all that, you know. I saw Giggles and Girls 4 times. A very good show that was.
Play acting? I think it's unhealthy. All that flowery language.
Then I saw, Yes, We Have No Pyjamas 3 times. Yeah. Now, if they did that sort of thing at the National Theatre, I'd go along and see them. Oh, yes. Yes, I'd definitely go and see that sort of thing.
Do I go to the theatre? Oh, no, no. We don't go in for that sort of thing.
No, we don't go.
Do we,
no,
Bert?
We don't do that, do we?
No.
No, I don't. I mean,
well,
so, you know.
Do that.
No, of course, not in our position.
Don't talk to me about actors. Actors? What? Panzers, a lot of them.
Yeah, well, the last time I went to the theatre, it's when they took my appendix out. Not much to laugh at. Slept through the whole performance. Yeah? Jolly good.
I watch telly. Yes, I always watch the telly. But at least in Coronation Street, they're real people, not a load of actors saying things they don't mean.
The theatre is part of our rich cultural heritage. But does it mean so little to us today? To people like you and me, the ordinary man and woman, I pose this question, and others. What is theatre? Is the theatre alive? Where is the real theatre? This is the subject of tonight's edition of Investigation. Perhaps the real theatre, the true theatre, the living theatre, is to be found in the provinces, at the grassroots. And so I went to Smallport-on-Sea, the well-known holiday resort crouched between the slag heaps on the east and the steelworks to the west. The bracing wind from the North Sea sweeps through this busy industrial town of 100,000 inhabitants. Searching for the real theatre, I visited first the producer of the local repertory company, Valentine Spode, in his office at the theatre.
Well, of course, we think this is where the real theatre is. We work on a shoestring, but we're all dedicated. There's glamour and glitter in the theatre, even though the pay is bad and the plumbing's a damn disgrace. We're rehearsing a fascinating new play at the moment called The Butler Did It. I say rehearsing, but I prefer to call it building a play. We mould it, we shape it, we create it until it becomes, well, how do I phrase it, a major work of art.
And to emphasise his words, Valentine Spode invited me to attend one of the rehearsals of the new play, The Butler Did It.
Come on, it's 10:30, loves. Let's attempt it. Come on.
Excuse me, where do you want me to sit?
Oh, just here, be fine.
Just here, okay.
Come on, let's start rehearsing, boys and girls. Terence, love, start with Act 1, Scene 1, will you, at the top?
Is this Lady Barton's residence?
Oh, how you startled me.
Did you not hear me knock on the French windows? My name's Inspector Bradley, C.I.D.
Inspector Bradley, C.I.D.? Are you a police officer?
Quite correct.
Super play, this is really fascinating. Pauline's a lovely little artist too, and a very good wardrobe. Mr. Speck's a lovely skip.
Has been missing from his home here for 8 days, and whose disappearance cannot be explained at home.
Lady Barton is in the dining room.
Don't giggle, love.
Sorry. Lady Barton is in the dining room having breakfast with Geoffrey Smallpiece, a handsome and wealthy young farmer.
No, Ducky. I want you to keep it brittle. Come on. Keep the speeches flowing. Keep them pear-shaped, love.
Be louder.
Oh, God. Yes. Stupid little bit.
Oh, Geoffrey Smallpiece, you say? Is he the tall young man with the private income? A black moustache and white Rolls Royce parked outside?
No, you're making it too... Oh, come on, I want it more, you know, tighter, more green in it, dear.
What, you mean say it faster?
Exactly.
Incidentally, Val, will these trousers be all right?
Yes. You wore them last week, you might as well wear them this week.
Thanks, Val.
Back once more in his office, Valentine Spode spoke to me about his hopes and his fears for the theatre.
We put on these exciting new plays, but people just want to watch this blasted television rubbish. That's what's killing the theatre, you see. I care for the theatre, it's in my blood and the very air I breathe. Are you BBC or ITV?
BBC.
Oh, yes, well... If you happen to be passing TV Centre, I wonder if you'd care to mention my name around the place. I've just got to get away from this godforsaken dump.
And so I left Valentine Spode optimistically planning the future of his repertory company. But some may say that the real theatre is to be found at Smallport's new Civic Theatre. It's not a proscenium theatre, it's not a theatre in the round, but a theatre in the square.
Ah, that's right. Yeah. Ah, that's it, right here, in the market square. Bang in the middle, they build. What's the use of culture if you can't park the blooming car? That's what I say. You BBC, are you?
That's right.
I had the privilege and pleasure of talking to the resident playwright, 18-year-old bearded Anthony Gland. Already a well-known figure in Smallport, Mr. Gland is a remarkable person with 11 A-levels, open-toe sandals, rear admiral's tunic and fur coat.
Mr. Gland, I wonder...
No, call me Tone. I'm a person, you know, I'm a person.
Yes. What are you aiming to do here in this new civic theatre, Tone?
Well, I want to move away from those mercenary fascists who run the commercial theatre. I want to help create a breathing theatre. I don't really need actors. I want clay, you know, living clay so that I can spawn, you know. It's the word I've been looking for. I knew I'd got it somewhere, the spawn. You see, spawn, I want to spawn a vital emotional experience. You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. Tone, I know that tonight is the opening night of your first play, which you've entitled Stomach.
Yeah.
You describe it as, what, a symbolic documentary in blank verse. Do you think that this is what the citizens want to see?
Look, man, the people here sweat and toil, the steelworks and the slag heaps all day, you know what I mean? All they want to do at night, you know, they want to escape, they want to be revitalised,
By the magic of the theatre.
I couldn't have phrased it better myself. Now, my play shows the degeneration of a man who sweated and toiled his life away in the steelworks all day, you know. He's been crushed by materialism, so at the end, he commits suicide by burying himself, as his wife and his 12 kids and a hamster in the slag heap.
This is absolutely splendid new theatre.
Yeah.
Where exactly is the stage?
Stage? I'm moving forward, man. There's no stage. The protagonist will be suspended from the scaffolding, right up in the ceiling, up there, you see.
But won't the audience have difficulty in seeing what's going on?
Oh, I don't want audiences to see. I don't care if there is an audience. You can spawn a vital emotional experience without a crowd of materialistic Philistines watching you. I'm not a money-grubbing impresario living a life of luxury in a huge flat with two Rolls Royces and a gorgeous mini-skirted secretary. I mean, you don't know anyone in television, do you?
Later, I was privileged to attend the first night of Anthony Glown's Stomach in the new Civic Theatre. There's an air of excitement here in the stalls bar of the new Civic Theatre. The first act has just ended, and I can see from the faces around me that the audience have experienced something, well, unusual. Real theatre, perhaps? The glittering local celebrities are certainly here in force tonight. The mayor of Smallport, the town clerk, and his lady wife. The sanitary inspector, the manager of the bedding department of J.R. Evans, and last but not least, one of the town's leading dramatic critics who is, at this moment, standing here at the bar beside me. Mr. Robson, will you say a few words?
Well, the stools are very comfortable, and I think they're water than whiskey. I'm sorry, I've had 9 doubles, and they seem to get weaker and weaker.
What do you think of the play?
What? Has it started? Now I've fallen over.
Excuse me, miss.
Yes, sir?
Small whiskey, please. Tell me, what do you think of the play?
Oh, I think it's very good. Yes, the bar's been full all evening.
Perhaps, at last, we've found the real theatre, the cash register. Back in London, in the heart of Theatreland, I talked with an impresario.
Look, if a play makes money, it's a good play. If it loses money, it's bad. I mean, people may say it's good, but it's not. It's bad. Same with a bad play. A bad play can be very good. This doesn't mean that a good play isn't good, but it's very rarely good. Sometimes it isn't bad, but usually it's not much good. But a good play, when it's good, can sometimes be really good. But by and large, however, you'll find a bad play is better. I hope that answers your question. You'll have to excuse me. Linda, what the hell are you doing with that inkpot?
And there you have it. We've heard from writers, directors, actors, and managers. And I pose the question, what have we discovered about the real theatre? The answer must be, as always, very little. Perhaps, after all, the true answer lies with the man in the street.
What did you think of the play, sir?
I never saw it. I've been here in the street all evening.
You've been listening to Lines from My Grandfather's Forehead, starring Ronnie Barker, with Terence Brady, Pauline Yates, and Gordon Langford at the piano. The lines were written by Tony Bilbo and Mike Fentiman, John Graham, Chris Miller, Harold Pinter, Robert W. Service, Gerald Wiley, and Gordon Langford. The programme was produced by John Fawcett Wilson.